comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, a car bomb explodes outside the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad.
And the head of the U.S.-backed national TV network in Iraq quits, saying the U.S. is losing the war of words to Al Jazeera.
Also, the California governor's race gets some star power he hopes to hasta la vista at the polls.
And remembering the Confederate General Robert E. Lee, was he really a great military mind?
There tends to be a consensus that Lee was a great defensive general, and on offense, he pulled off a lot of victories that were in large part luck or just sheer audacity.
These stories and a new CD from the late Celia Cruz, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Secretary of State Colin Powell is sending condolences to Jordan after a powerful car bomb exploded outside the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad today. Powell said it's a reminder that the civilized world must come together to fight the scourge of terrorism. The blast killed at least 11 people, including a woman and two children. NPR's Ivan Watson tells us it also did a great deal of damage.
It blew apart a 10-foot wall that surrounded the perimeter of this embassy, and it has caused damage to houses across the street, blown out windows, and there are at least three or four vehicles that have been reduced to twisted wreckage by the explosions. The American soldiers as well as Iraqi police have established this security cordon around this region, and they're just beginning to sift through the wreckage to try to make sense of what exactly happened.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. Tensions between Iraq and Jordan have been high because of Jordan's support for the war on Iraq. Last week, Jordan granted asylum to Saddam Hussein's two eldest daughters. Two more American soldiers have been killed in Iraq. They died in a gun battle last night in Baghdad. The first West African peacekeeping troops have entered Liberia's capital. NPR's Jason Bobian tells us cheering, dancing crowds greeted about 100 Nigerian soldiers as they drove into Monrovia.
Nigerian troops were actually coming through this street, which is a four-lane street. It's completely packed with people in front of the vehicles, behind the vehicles, and as they went along, just now looking down the street, this entirely lined with pedestrians who are now just so slowly trickling along behind the Nigerian troops as they move into the center of the city.
NPR's Jason Bobian speaking to us from Monrovia. Liberian President Charles Taylor has said he will hand over power on August 11th. An Indonesian Muslim militant has been sentenced to death for his part in the nightclub attacks that killed 202 people on the resort island of Bali. Amrozi bin Nurhasim is the first of the accused bombers to stand trial. The BBC's Rachel Harvey tells us Amrozi faced a variety of charges.
He was convicted on four counts of terrorism. He was convicted of conspiring, planning and carrying out the Bali attacks. Specifically, the prosecution had argued that Amrozi's role was to buy the explosives and the white van used in the attack. He was kind of like a quartermaster, if you like. Now, the defense have said, well, he wasn't the mastermind. He was just one of the more junior players. And so they are appealing against the death sentence, saying that it was too severe.
The BBC's Rachel Harvey is covering the trial in Bali. Stocks are trading higher this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 41 points to 9103 in moderate trade. The Nasdaq is up 2 points to 1655. The S&P 500 is up 4 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, the Labor Department reports productivity grew at an annual rate of 5.7% between April and June. The second quarter showing was the best since the third quarter of 2002. Productivity measures the amount that an employee produces per hour of work. During the first 3 months of the year, productivity grew by just 2.1%. Intel says the Internal Revenue Service has proposed that the company pay an additional $600 million in taxes for the years 1999 and 2000. Intel says the IRS may also examine earlier years. From San Francisco, Jason Lopez has more.
Intel says it disagrees with the IRS announcement that the firm owes more taxes. The issue isn't a new one for the chipmaker. About 10 years ago, Intel and the tax authorities were at odds over how much of a tax credit the firm could claim related to exports. As a multinational company, Intel frequently transfers products and materials across borders. According to the firm, the IRS reevaluated Intel's export tax credits for 1999 and 2000. Intel also reiterated its opposition to expensing stock options. The world's biggest chipmaker said its profit in the April through June quarter would have been $300 million less than the $896 million it reported had stock options offered to employees been counted as an expense. For NPR News, I'm Jason Lopez in San Francisco.
The Bank of England has decided to keep its benchmark interest rate at 3.5%. It cut the rate by a quarter of a point last month. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Gail Harris in for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Two U.S. soldiers from the 1st Armored Division were killed in a gun battle in Baghdad today. The shooting deaths mark the end of 4 days of relative calm with no combat fatalities and bring the total of U.S. troops killed since the end of major fighting was declared over 3 months ago to 55. Also in Baghdad today, a massive car bomb rocked the downtown area just outside the Jordanian embassy. Several cars were reduced to shrapnel. One vehicle was tossed onto the roof of a nearby building. After the initial explosion, a group of young men stormed the damaged building and began destroying pictures of Jordan's King Abdullah II and his late father, King Hussein. At least 11 were killed in the blast, more than 50 people injured. Nabil al-Sharif, the Jordanian information minister, had this response.
Jordan condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist act that took place today in the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad.
Well, the target of today's blast was obviously the embassy of Iraq's neighbor Jordan. The question is, why? We're joined now on the line by Dr. Kamal Abu Jaber, former foreign minister of Jordan and currently teaching in Calgary, Canada. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
Well, doctor, tell us a little bit about the relationship and the history of Jordan and Iraq that might lead to them targeting the embassy.
Well, like I say, I don't think this is a responsible group of Iraqis by any long shot. And you ask me why the attack on the Jordanian embassy. Is it because of Jordan's stand in this last war or in the previous war when Jordan was one of the very, very few nations in the whole world that stood with Iraq and refused to condone the attack on it?
So you say possibly because Jordan switched its position, declaring opposition to Saddam?
Look, everybody on the whole world has declared opposition to Saddam, and Jordan's stand, of course, was no different than any of the neighboring Arab countries. Or is it because of the Jordanian giving asylum to the daughters of Saddam? Again, this is against the very moral and decent values of Arab chivalry in total and Iraqi chivalry in particular. How can Jordan say no to two women who have lost whatever it is they have with nine children with them? How can Jordan turn them out?
Yeah. So some have speculated that this might be tied to the two daughters of Saddam Hussein gaining asylum in Jordan. But after the bombing, there were demonstrations inside what was left of the embassy, people tearing up images of the king and King Hussein.
Yes. I saw that, and I thought that was also very sad. Again, the only explanation I give is really that's done by a bunch of irresponsible hoodlums. Look, the Iraqis have been in a constant state of war since 1980. 23, and this is a full-fledged war or sanctions You are talking about disoriented, traumatized people, people who are confused, who doesn't know right from wrong.
What about current relationships between the countries? We hear that there may be resentment of Jordan by Iraqis for treatment of Iraqi workers in Jordan.
Well, I don't know if that is true. I don't believe that there is any bad treatment of Iraqis in Jordan. The relationship between Jordan and Iraq from the 1920s on really have been, by and large, on the very amicable, friendly, decent side. Jordan depended something like 40% of the Jordanian economy depended on the Iraqi economy prior to the war of 1990 on 1991. And even during the sanctions period from 1991 until the latest attack on Iraq, the Jordanian outlet was the only breathing space from which the Iraqis could travel, could trade, could work in Iraq. And again, there was a very strong cultural and political and economic ties between the two countries.
Weren't there actually familial ties? Wasn't the last Iraqi king related to the royal families of Jordan?
Of course, you know, the King Faisal, who was killed in 1958 by a coup d'etat, was a first cousin, actually, or a second, actually, of King Hussein. I mean, and they were from the same Hashemite family.
Yeah. So you just think that this is a small, but do you think it's an organized group, as you said, hoodlums?
I don't think it is an organized activity by... Look, there is no organization in Iraq. If anything is presently in Iraq, it's chaos and confusion. And no one knows. And the amazing thing is 3 months after the war has ended, because today is what? It's almost exactly 3 months. No one in Iraq knows what is going on. No one around Iraq knows what's going on in Iraq. And the invasion, where is it leading to? The Iraqis are very confused. Their country is under occupation. Their ministries are not working. There is no government to speak of in Iraq. And the Americans are under siege right now in Baghdad and in other major cities. It's a horribly sad situation that, these young Iraqis, whoever they may be, are really a symptom of the confusion and the disarray that exists.
Well, Dr. Jaber, thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Dr. Kamal Abu Jaber speaking to us from Canada, former foreign minister of Jordan.
The post-war head of Iraq's U.S.-backed national television network has quit, saying that the U.S. is losing the propaganda war there to other Arab broadcasters, including Al Jazeera. A former London-based correspondent for Radio Free Iraq, Ahmad al-Rakabi, helped recruit and train staff for the U.S.-backed TV station and became known as the voice of Free Iraq. In an interview with the Associated Press yesterday, al-Rakabi said that inadequate funding at the network made it extremely difficult to recruit and retain staff. The current situation, he said, makes it impossible for Iraqi TV to compete with other broadcasters for the attention of Iraqis. The resignation comes at a time when many reports say that U.S. forces are struggling to win the trust of the Iraqi people. We turn to Stephen Claypole, former chief executive of Associated Press Television, and until recently an international broadcasting advisor to the coalition authority in Baghdad. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you have known Ahmad al-Rakabi for a long time and, in fact, spoke with him this morning. What did he tell you about this?
That's correct. I've known of Ahmed's reputation through quite a long period of time, and I joined him back in April in Kuwait, where he was setting up, first of all, the radio service of the Iraqi Media Network. And this morning when I spoke to him, he's feeling very frustrated and very let down, and he believes that the Iraqi Media Network television project was under-resourced and underfunded, and that the difficulties in running it just became far too much, so he resigned.
So it is chiefly a money issue, not a philosophical difference of opinion?
Well, I think there's a number of elements to this. I think the frustrating thing from his perspective was what he saw as being under-resourcing of the network. But I think also there's been a philosophical issue over the editorial control of the Iraqi media network.
Well, I want to get back to that point in just a moment. But first of all, you certainly know what a daunting challenge this was. I mean, 3 months is not a long time to set up a television network in a place that barely has electricity. And in fact, some areas still don't have it. I wonder if his expectations might have been too high as to what was possible right away.
I don't think so. He was brought into the scheme of things quite early on. You know, certainly at the time the original Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance was being set up. And, you know, he moved all the way from Kuwait up to Baghdad, was involved in the radio broadcasting initially. So I don't think he underestimated the task, but it was hugely difficult. I mean, a lot of people don't understand that the team that went in to set up the transmitters and to set up the operation actually came under fire and were being attacked by, Ba'athist elements in Baghdad. And it was extremely dangerous and very fraught for everybody involved.
And what about this philosophical issue? Because I gather that the expectation from some of the U.S. forces was that this was going to be a chance to get their point of view, their story out. And perhaps others thought, no, it should be a more neutral news-gathering operation.
Well, I think that the model really was the Voice of America. But the problem here was that Washington panicked when Jay Garner was there and couldn't understand why, you know, Jay Garner wasn't getting a message across or his message across to the Iraqi people. So a lot of pressure built up to get the Iraqi media network up and running. And at that stage, the public affairs people at OHAR really sort of intervened and began to control the operations of the network.
And of course, the Iraqis have been subject to nothing but propaganda, certainly for the last 30 years. How do you think a less propagandistic television news organization would play there? Are people hungry to get this kind of information that's not colored by a particular point of view?
Yes, and to be fair to the Iraqi media network and the people who've been running it, a lot of coverage and a lot of programming, has been conducted along, the lines and by the standards of the Western media. But the whole thing has been under government control, and it's not really the way to do things, in my view. And, there needs to be a degree of independence, at least between government and the broadcasting organization in a situation such as this. I mean, down the line, there should be total independence from government and authority. But that's going to be less easy to achieve if, at this stage, the coalition is taking editorial decisions and intervening in what the service broadcasts.
And is Al Jazeera seen as a believable, credible news-gathering operation, or is it seen as a place with a point of view?
Well, I think that it's seen as an organization with a point of view, but that point of view is quite welcome in certain quarters in Baghdad and among the Iraqi audience. The problem is that a hot item almost since the day Saddam's statue came down in Ferdow Square has been satellite dishes. There was an immediate delivery of satellite dishes into central Iraq, and they've been coming up by the truckload, and satellite television is taking off very rapidly, and that's understandable in a country that's been repressed and intimidated through so many years.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Okay.
Stephen Claypole is a former international broadcasting advisor to the Coalition Authority in Iraq. He spoke to us today from London. We did contact Science Applications International Corporation. That's the U.S. company that holds the Defense Department contract to manage the Iraq television network, to talk with them about the resignation of al-Rakabi, but the company had no comment.
Just ahead, a look back at the military career of the Confederate General Robert E. Lee with author Roy Blunt, Jr.
And later in the program, renaming Atlanta's airport. Which former mayor, now deceased, should get that honor?
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Hero in the South, enemy in the North. General Robert E. Lee, leader of the Confederate Army, was a complicated man, a reluctant leader, and to Southern writer and humorist Roy Blunt, Jr., largely misunderstood. Blunt has written a new biography on the Southern general called Robert E. Lee. We conclude our conversation now with Blunt about the Virginian who led half the country in a time of civil war and even today remains an important symbol in American history.
For a long time, he was a unifying symbol, this dignified, distant, handsome man who seemed to represent goodwill, which was bringing people back together after the terrible bloodshed and divisiveness of the Civil War. More recently, however, there are people who think of him as a symbol of treason and slavery.
Was he a military genius? Because he was certainly viewed that way by generations of Southerners.
Yeah, I mean, there tends to be a consensus that Lee was a great defensive general, and on offense he pulled off a lot of victories that were in large part luck or just sheer audacity, but he also lost a lot of battles on offense. So, and the war was such a muddle. I mean, nobody's instructions tended to get lost, and Lee was vague about his instructions to begin with. So that I'm much more comfortable in finding genius in writers than I am in generals anyway. But especially that war, which just seemed half the time it had to do with the weather which subordinates fought the hardest.
You pointed out that Gettysburg was the last time that Lee actually took the offensive. And I wonder if that was because he just didn't have the men, having lost a third of his army there, or was it for other reasons?
After Gettysburg, they had lost so many men and had so many deserters, and they had no food, and their uniforms were all in tatters, and they were ill-supplied altogether, and the Confederate Congress was busy, as Lee said, eating peanuts and chewing tobacco and arguing about silly things. So that, and the states didn't really hold together, so he was in no position to. He tried to make an audacious thrust into the North, and it didn't work, so he just fell back on protecting Richmond as long as he could and hoping for some kind of deliverance.
Roy, I suppose that many people don't know that Robert E. Lee had a farewell address. I wonder if you'd read it for us.
Yeah, a farewell to his troops. He didn't deliver it himself. In fact, he didn't even write this, actually, but it was written by his instruction by a staff officer, and it has gone down in history. It's pretty eloquent, I think, and it does sound like Lee. It goes like this. You will take with you the satisfaction that proceeds from the consciousness of duty faithfully performed, and I earnestly pray that a merciful God will extend to you his blessing and protection. With an increasing admiration of your constancy and devotion to your country, and a grateful remembrance of your kind and generous consideration of myself, I bid you an affectionate farewell. R. E. Lee, General.
It's fascinating that he was also accused of treason, but never tried, and it took a long time before he was pardoned.
Yeah, he applied for a pardon, and Secretary of War just sort of tossed it aside, and it was not until the Gerald Ford administration that he was officially pardoned.
So that was, 110 years later?
Yeah, I guess so, something like that.
What did he do after the war?
I think he was able to do more what he should have been doing in life all along, which was to go into education. He was became president of Little Washington College, which had just about been destroyed by the war, and he built it back up into a good-sized college. He liberalized the curriculum, and he took a nurturing interest in his students, and he averted a lynching at one point when some of his students were about to take a black man out of jail and perhaps hang him. He stepped in and intervened and said, "You young men," he just sort of showed up all of a sudden, and they slunk away in shame.
You've been researching this, writing about this man for 4 years now, maybe more. Having done all this work, what's your feeling about Robert E. Lee? Is this a man you like or respect or admire?
You know, I think that to see him as an arch villain or an arch hero is to dehumanize him either way. And I tried in my book to see him as a human being, which was not easy because he tended not to open up very often to show himself as human. But he did from time to time, and when he did, he was a much more appealing person than when he was purely noble or purely angry, which he was sometimes too.
One last question. He, of course, is well known for the quote about, "It is well that war is so terrible, lest we become too fond of it."
Yeah, I've been thinking about that quote a lot. It's sort of typical of Lee to be so ambivalent about something, you know. And it's not as if he stopped fighting the war. I mean, he just didn't enjoy it. But then a lot of things he didn't enjoy. I mean, I had the thought the other day that Lee was anticipating a form of war that wasn't so horrible that people could become fond of, which maybe somehow he foresaw football.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. Thank you so much, Roy Blunt.
Okay, had a good time.
Roy Blunt, Jr. is author of the new book, Robert E. Lee. The book is part of the Penguin Live series. For more information, check out our website at here-now.org.
Back with my wife in Tennessee, and one day she said to me, "Virgil, quick, come see, there goes the Robert E. Lee."
Tomorrow on Here and Now, before he went to work for the Pentagon, John Poindexter was best known for his part in the Iran-Contra affair. Whatever happened to the other players in that scandal?
Also, in light of the Kobe Bryant case, what happens when a huge national story breaks in your small town? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Arnold Schwarzenegger surprises everyone.
And renaming Atlanta's airport, which former mayor should get the honor, the white one or the black one?
I've heard you can't go to heaven or hell without going through Atlanta Hartsfield. But at heart, what I find is very interesting is kind of a re-energizing of public interest in the city's history and in the role that these two mayors played.
And Celia Cruz. Cancer took her life, but not her spirit.
She says that the doctor found out that she had life in her, and it was the music, it was rhythm, it was song, it was dance.
Celia Cruz's last CD coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. In Baghdad, some of the worst violence since the end of the major fighting in the U.S.-led war. There was a fierce gun battle involving U.S. troops today, and overnight, two American soldiers died in another firefight. And this morning, a car bomb went off outside the Jordanian embassy, killing at least 11 people. Jordanian Information Minister Nabil al-Sharif says the bombers were trying to harm relations between Jordan and Iraq.
We think that this cowardly terrorist act is aimed at deviating Jordan from its path of support for Iraq, and this is not going to happen. We will continue our support for the brotherly Iraqi people.
Secretary of State Colin Powell offered U.S. condolences to the victims of the bombing this morning. The Liberian Congress has approved the decision of President Charles Taylor to appoint his vice president as his successor when he steps down next week. Meantime, a Pentagon spokesman says the U.S. welcomes the arrival of West African peacekeepers to Liberia's capital of Monrovia. But the Bush administration says the number of American forces there isn't expected to go beyond 20. Europe continues to suffer through a deadly heat wave, and forecasters don't see any relief in sight until September. Wildfires fanned by hot winds are being reported from Portugal to Greece. At least 38 deaths are blamed on the heat wave. Attorney General John Ashcroft is paving the way for more government appeals of prison sentences that are considered too light. Ashcroft sent a letter to federal prosecutors telling them to report to the Justice Department whenever a judge hands down a light sentence. Critics say the move will hamper the ability of courts to impose fair and reasonable penalties. California Governor Gray Davis may have to rethink his campaign strategy with the entrance of a big-name actor into the recall race. Arnold Schwarzenegger says he's running for governor as a Republican and should be taken seriously as a candidate.
I have the energy, I have the intelligence, I have the know-how, I know what the problems are in this state. I know that we have to, first of all, and most important, bring business back to California, because we can be talking from here to eternity about programs. The most important thing is money.
Actor Gary Coldman has also paid the entry fee to join the race, as has comedian Gallagher. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are generally up. The Dow is up 39 points at 91.01, and the Nasdaq is up 4 points at 16.57.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's announcement last night that he'll run for governor of California sent politicians who weren't already in one into a tailspin. Here's Schwarzenegger speaking last night.
I know how to sell something, because remember, I had to sell bodybuilding when no one even knew what bodybuilding was in this country. And we did it. And I had to sell myself as an action hero, which wasn't easy when everyone said, hey, your name is what, Schwarzenschnitzel or something like that? And you have an accent, and you have this overdeveloped body. No one ever could be successful with this kind of a combination. And I did it, because I sold myself to the American people.
Within hours of the announcement, Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante broke party ranks to become the first Democrat to announce his candidacy and challenge his boss, Governor Gray Davis. On the line is Sacramento Bee reporter Sam Stanton. Sam, welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, the pundits all said Arnold's not going to run. How stunned are people today?
Everyone was shocked. Even his closest advisors apparently were standing at the
in the studio watching, and when he took the stage, they still expected him to say he wasn't going to run.
What happened? Do we know what happened to change his mind?
Well, apparently he's a brilliant tactician. How he managed to keep this secret is beyond me, because, as you know, that never works in politics, but it did this time. Everyone, the governor, everyone else, was knocked back on their heels by this announcement. Now they've got to deal with a guy who's got unlimited money, unlimited star power, and unlimited publicity machines.
Right. There are people who might dismiss Arnold Schwarzenegger as, you know, just another actor, but he is hugely popular. Some think he's refreshing. We all remember Jesse Ventura was dismissed as well. And Gray Davis is, well, gray.
Well, and that's been the hallmark of his career. He ran on being gray and being steady. Schwarzenegger's experience is extremely limited. He ran an initiative last year on after-school care, but that's been the extent of his political experience, other than speaking to the Republican National Convention.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit more about the Democratic conference call that happened yesterday, when apparently at least half of the congressional delegation got on the phone to decide what they would do. This was before Arnold Schwarzenegger tossed his hat in the ring.
Right. Well, they have been panicked now since last weekend, when some polling figures came out that one insider described as gruesome for the Democrats. Ever since then, they have been trying to figure out how to get a named Democrat on the second part of the ballot. The first part of the ballot is yes or no, should Gray Davis keep his job? The second is who you want to replace him. They were all hoping for Feinstein. Yesterday, after Feinstein pulled out, they had another conference call. At one point, Nancy Pelosi floated the name of George Miller, who's a Democratic congressman from the Bay Area, but they couldn't reach consensus on that. The only thing that they did agree is that they wanted a named Democrat on the ballot. In the meantime, a couple of hours after Schwarzenegger's announcement on the Tonight Show, the lieutenant governor, Cruz Bustamante, who scheduled the election for October 7th and at the same time vowed he would not run.
Yes, calling it an expensive perversion of the recall process.
That's right. So he announced he's going to run. He'll be doing that this morning. And then later this morning, the insurance commissioner, John Garamendi, will be announcing his candidacy. So you have what the Republicans here are referring to as the jailbreak. They are just ecstatic, because in their mind, the more Democrats you have, the better off they're going to be.
Is it fair to say it's sort of a mess out there?
You know, I covered a recall once before. I worked in Arizona during Governor Evan Meekum's tenure, and I thought that was crazy. You know, at that time, they impeached him, indicted him, and tried to recall him at the same time. But, you know, California is so big and has so much media, this is just nuts. Every hour, you hear something different. And no one... You know, no one knows which way the campaign will go, if Davis will go negative again, if he'll try to be a statesman. It just defies prediction at this point.
And in the meantime, we're talking about who will lead the world's sixth largest economy.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you.
Sam Stanton is a reporter with the Sacramento Bee.
For decades, Atlanta, Georgia, has been calling itself the city too busy to hate. Well, perhaps Atlantans have a little too much time on their hands these days, because a fight over race has become big news there. Some residents want to change the name of Hartsfield Airport, which honors aviation pioneer and longtime mayor William Hartsfield, and make it Maynard Jackson Airport, after Atlanta's first African-American mayor, who recently died. Here to talk about the controversy is Andy Ambrose, Deputy Director of the Atlanta History Center. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you.
I understand letters are pouring into City Hall about this. There's been at least one hearing. What's the tone of the debate?
Well, I think the debate encompasses a wide range of ideas about how best to honor Maynard Jackson and all his contributions to the city. And some of those include, as you suggested, the possible renaming of Hartsfield International Airport in Jackson's honor.
Well, how much of this is about race, and how much do you think about Atlanta's own sense of history? Because it is mostly African-American residents who seem to want the name changed, but it's also true that Atlanta has always been a place that celebrated what's new and perhaps more so than what's old.
Well, I wouldn't want to characterize it strictly as a racial debate. The larger question for me is, how do you honor one individual without removing an honor to another earlier individual? Racial considerations do enter into it, as they often are going to do in city politics, but I don't think that's the essence of it.
Well, and isn't there a downside, in fact, for the Jackson supporters? I mean, if you can change it from Hartsfield to Jackson, then can't you change it another 30 years from Jackson to somebody else?
Oh, I think so. And I think what's of interest to me here is that this debate has refocused kind of some public interest, which I see as a good thing, in exactly who these two mayors were and what they contributed to the city. Hartsfield was kind of the grandfather of aviation here. If it wasn't for him, none of the airport wouldn't have gotten off the ground. He presided at the first opening of the Atlanta Municipal Airport. He was the one who, almost on his own initiative, got the city to lease and later purchase Candler Field. So I think the honor was fitting. At the same time, Jackson, during the early part of his administration, was given this task of building a $400 million new terminal. And he not only did it, but I think even more critically, he brought about the involvement of minority firms, and one that was really replicated or modeled on in other cities after that.
And, of course, now Atlanta is such an aviation hub. The joke goes, as I'm sure you know, that you can't go anywhere in the South without going through Atlanta first.
That's right. I've heard you can't go to heaven or hell without going through Atlanta Hartsfield. But at heart, what I find is very interesting is kind of a re-energizing of public interest in the city's history and in the role that these two mayors played.
A good discussion to be having, then.
Yes, certainly. I see it as very helpful one to be going on, and I think it's one that hopefully we can play into.
Thanks, Andy.
My pleasure.
Andy Ambrose is Deputy Director of the Atlanta History Center, part of the Atlanta Historical Society.
Still to come, the last CD from the late Queen of Salsa, Celia Cruz.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Listener Stephen Banzart of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, responded to accusations that the website for a support group for gay and lesbian teens, co-founded by newly appointed Episcopalian Bishop Gene Robinson, contained links to pornography sites. He writes, "Pornography is the Kevin Bacon of the Internet. Virtually everything is connected to it. It's really only a question of how many links it takes to get there. There's a big difference between directly linking to adult sites and linking to an innocuous site that, five more steps down the line, links to an adult site."
Well, Alfred Gianantonio wrote to us from Tarma, Italy, where he listens to us on the web. "Thanks for your program about the pros and cons of aiding Liberia. You should place more emphasis on why the USA does not consider Liberia strategic enough to send troops in right away. This is part of the Bush Doctrine."
Stephen Gilmore of Charlotte, North Carolina, wrote in after hearing pop critic Tim Riley's review about aging alternative girl rockers. He says that Amy Rigby and Juliana Hatfield only get better with age, and he thought the same was true of Liz Phair, but he says she let me down with her detour into commercial pop. Hopefully she'll be towed back onto the road of respectability, and she too will continue to improve with age, just like Amy and Juliana.
Well, many of you are horrified that we didn't know the derivation of the name Seabiscuit in our review of the film. Well, many, including Karen Nelson of Public Radio East in New Bern, North Carolina, hi Karen, wrote, she says, "Seabiscuit is the son of Hardtack and Swing On. Hardtack is the son of Man of War and T-Biscuit." And then others of you reminded us, Seabiscuit is another name for hardtack, which is a hard, dry biscuit sailors used to eat at sea. But Dr. Lester Hartman of Westwood, Massachusetts, had yet another definition for Seabiscuit.
"A Seabiscuit is a shell similar to a sand dollar, but however thicker and larger."
We have them on our shores here on the East Coast. They're fun to pick up. People collect them.
Yes.
But they have more meaning.
Yes, I think they've had Christian overtones in the past, because when you open the shell up, the skeleton looks like small doves and had been attributed to as the doves of peace, as kind of a Christian symbol.
Well, please tell us, did you see some religious overtones in the film?
Well, I kind of had some equating a little bit with the Billy Budd figure in Herman Melville. He was a bit of a sacrificial lamb in a sense, a very persistent horse, the underdog, and the nation watched him closely, and he overcame the odds and yet was injured and, in a sense, was somewhat sacrificed for the betterment of the country at the time during the Depression.
Well, Dr. Hartman, we'll have to have you come in and review one of our next movies.
Thank you.
That's deep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And lastly, Randy Bra wrote in from Phoenix, Arizona, about Chef Kathy Gunst's corn fritters. He writes, "I made the fritters for dinner, and my cornaholic wife was in heaven. I used a marvelous white corn from Olathe, Colorado, that we get this time of the year in Phoenix. And," Randy adds, "I listened to you on KJZZ in Phoenix. And to paraphrase an old Madeline Kahn line, you give good radio. The show's diversity is incredible."
Well, thank you. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your name, phone number, and town where you live. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Celia Cruz, known as the Queen of Salsa, was one of Cuba's, one of the world's most beloved singers. She died on July 16th.
Lo que es bueno hoy, quizás no lo sea mañana.
Celia Cruz recorded over 70 albums during her long career. This song, Laugh and Cry, is from her last CD, Regalo del Alma, which has just been released posthumously. And Here and Now's Latin music lover, Jose Maso, is in the studio to tell us more about the woman who was mourned as if she really was royalty. Right, Jose?
Robin, you hit it right on the mark. It was something amazing to be in New York City during a day in which thousands, I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of both dignitaries and just people from all walks of life, from the governor of New York to Hillary Clinton to the mayor to just, you know, fans. And I'm talking about fans of all ages and all nationalities turning out during a rainy day to pay tribute to this queen who, in many ways, was a queen.
Yeah, some of us saw the pictures from the wake and the mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral, but it's still hard to, I mean, I've heard of stories of people who packed up their kids and traveled for hours to be there. Why?
I think in many ways she was able to succeed against all tides. I mean, she started early in the late 1940s when she was a young lady in Cuba, hooked on with one of the most popular group songs known as La Sonora Matancera, traveled throughout Latin America and became very popular. And then while she was touring in Mexico was when the overthrow took place and Fidel Castro took over, and she swore she would never go back until he either passed away or there was a change in government. So she was a very strong individual when it came to her love for her country in Cuba, and I think that many people respected that, and I think that folks, you know, identified with her personal struggle and the fact that she succeeded here in the United States as a black woman, a Cuban woman, somebody who is away from her country because of political reasons, and someone who was in a world of men. And at the same time, she was able to always reinvent herself. In the 1970s, in the 1960s, she worked with Tito Puente. In the 1970s, Johnny Pacheco brought her the Fania Records, and that's when a lot of young people started hearing her again. And then in the 80s with the Fania All-Stars, with Ray Barreto, with Willie Colon, and then finally, now in the 1990s and the 2000s, she had just became an icon, and she was known as La Guarachera del Mundo, the Queen of Salsa.
Well, let's hear some of the music that helped get her that title. What are we listening for? Those who are new to Celia Cruz, what makes it unique?
Well, a few things. One is the excitement in her voice and also the splendor that you hear in her voice, although this being her last CD is nothing compared to her work there in the last seven decades, because, of course, you would have heard a very young, energetic voice. But it still shares with us, you know, the warmth and the real love that she has for the music and this type of music, which is Afro-Cuban, and at the same time, the ability to be with it, if you will, in the sense that she's able to add new things to her repertoire. So she'll hear a little bit of influence of pop and techno and rap and things of that nature. And at the same time, her trademark, which is azúcar, which you will hear throughout all of her CDs. And in this particular CD, she, I think, recognized the fact that she was going to soon pass away. And so a few of her songs, the one we heard earlier, Río y Llora, which is Laugh and Cry, tells us to laugh and cry and make do with every single day and take advantage every day. This next one, the Diagnóstico, which is a diagnostic, talks about a visit to a doctor, and you're thinking she's telling us the story about her visit to the doctor where she found out she had cancer, and it's quite the contrary. She says that the doctor found out that she had life in her, and it was the music, it was rhythm, it was song, it was dance.
Ay, yo llevo el son.
En el corazón.
A mí me suena el son.
En el corazón.
Que por el son tiene la razón de vivir latiendo mi corazón. Yo llevo el son.
Okay, Jose, sit still. Well, you can't. Azúcar, you said her trademark. What is that?
Azúcar, which means sugar. And she would say it from the stage, and it became basically her way of letting people know that she was on and she was on stage. And she was saying, you know, enjoy life. During the mass that took place at St. Patrick's, it was packed to the rafters. The homily, which was done by the Monsignor Josu Iriondo, he really captured the essence of who she was. And one of the things he said to us was that, Celia, you may have passed away, but your sugar will always be part of our coffee and always be part of our life. And this next selection is titled No Estés Amargo, Don't Be Bitter. She gives us the message, don't be bitter in life. Put some sugar in your life. Put some spice. Put some happiness. And this one is, again, her trademark, azúcar, Celia Cruz.
A mí siempre me preguntan por qué digo tanto azúcar. Y es que en la vida, señores, azúquita te la endulza. Y hay otro que dicen, Celia, yo no la puedo tomar. Pues te tomas poquitico que te va a endulzar igual. ¡Azúcar!
No estés amargo.
¡Otra vez!
Celia Cruz from her new CD, released posthumously. She recorded these in the last years of her life. It's amazing to think that she died at 77 and had 70 albums?
She died at 77, so they say. But and I say so they say because if you see her official biography in the program, there in the mass, you notice they don't put her birth date. And it's because some of us believe she may have been in her 80s. But let's say she was 77, 78 years old. And she was able to record from the late 1940s to 2003 over 70 albums with all those different groups that I mentioned before. She was a very busy woman, not only singing live and touring all throughout the world, but also recording. And this last one she did while she was ill. And from what I understand, the producer, Sergio George, understanding that he would have to take his time with her, and again, giving her the opportunity to really shine, knowing that this was going to be her last recording.
Mm. In her life, she was on the Divas Live. A lot of her,
yes,
people remember with Aretha Franklin.
Yes.
Then President Clinton awarded her the National Medal of Arts. Billboard magazine devoted a special issue to her. So she knew what she meant to people. Let's hear a little more of what she meant to leave them.
We're going to hear a song which is actually added as a bonus to this. It's titled Yo Vivire, which she had recorded before. And this is the Gloria Gaynor selection, I Will Survive. And I think it's become sort of like her anthem now for many of us, because what it says to us is that regardless if she's passed along, her music will always survive and her memory will survive. And so therefore, she's always going to be alive as far as we're concerned, because we're going to be able to hear, as far as there's technology, as long as there's technology, we will hear her music. And this is her way of telling us, I will survive. It's titled Yo Vivire.
Mi voz puede volar, puede atravesar cualquier herida, cualquier tiempo, cualquier soledad. Sin que la pueda controlar, toma forma de canción. Así es mi voz, que sale de mi corazón y volará, sin yo querer, por los caminos más lejanos, por los sueños que soñé. Será reflejo del amor, de lo que me tocó vivir. Será la música de fondo, de lo mucho que sentí. Oye mi son, mi viejo son, tiene la clave de cualquier generación, en el alma de mi gente, en el cuero del tambor, en las manos del conguero, en los pies del bailador, yo viviré.
Celia Cruz, and she does live on in this CD.
She does, and you know, this month we've lost a lot of great people. Compay Segundo passed away a couple of days before her. Matter of fact, it was on the day that she and her husband, Pedro Knight, who is the love of her life, celebrated her 41st anniversary. And then Celia passed away on the 16th, which happened to be the same day that Ruben Blades celebrates his birthday. And Ruben and I were talking. He said, you know, I'm always going to celebrate my birthday enjoying the fact that I was born on that day, but I'm going to remember Celia on that day, most importantly, by enjoying the life that she brought to who I am. And this last cut that I want to go out with, Robin, mm-hmm. was from her previous CD in 2002. She won another Grammy. And this one is titled La Negra Tiene Tumbao. And this particular cut is the one that I think that many young people are going to identify with in years to come, and it will be the one that will bring them to her past through this present music. It's titled La Negra Tiene Tumbao, and it's got a reggae, and it's got a rap, and it's got a dance feel to it amongst the young people. It's become the most popular selection of Celia Cruz's career.
La negra tiene tumbao. Translate that.
Which means the black woman's got rhythm. The black woman's got beat. Tiene tumbao. And she definitely had tumbao. She had that azúcar. Long live the queen, Celia Cruz.
Esa negrita que va caminando, esa negrita tiene su tumbao. Y cuando la gente la va mirando, ella baila de lado. También apretado, apretado, apretado.
La negra tiene tumbao.
Azúcar, azúcar.
Here now is Latin music lover Jose Maso, also hosts Con Salsa on WBUR in Boston. For more information about his love, Celia Cruz, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
The Iran-Contra.
These stories here and now.
The Iran-Contra.